Welcome to Equip, the podcast by Connection Church. My name is Jordan Thigpen. Today I'm joined by Quentin Thurman and Chris Miller, and we are going to be looking at the book of Daniel, part two. Let's get equipped. Good to be back.
We're here.
You guys have a good turkey day?
Oh, yeah.
I haven't seen y'all since then. I know it's like first week of December at this point, but I was out of town last week and missed you guys, man. Missed being around the office. If I could have chosen to be on a cruise ship or in the office with y'all, I would have chosen in the office.
Mm.
And anyone that knows me knows I am completely serious.
So. Yeah, we definitely missed your whistling down the halls. It was very quiet.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a trait that I've passed on to McClendon, and it is super annoying. So I apologize.
That's not how I meant it. Take it as you will.
No, I know sometimes my whistling can be aggravating, so I apologize for that.
It's just an
identifier. No apology needed. I whistle too, so
yeah,
right up my alley.
You might want to throw me in a lion's den if you would. Oh, there we go. Right into the Bible humor. All right, Daniel chapter 6. So we are picking up. Our goal with this was to cover the book of Daniel the way your everyday follower of Jesus might, if they were to sit down and try to understand maybe a book of the Bible that they have not spent a lot of time in, which, you know, I think that is a lot of our church, right? That a lot of our church, we by God's grace, reach a lot of people that have previously been far from God. We seem to enter into people's spiritual journeys when they are very young in their faith. And so there's lots of books of the Bibles that people are new to, that they are, that they have maybe never spent a lot of time reading. And Daniel is a great example of that. But like we talked about last week, there's lots of stories from Daniel that we are very familiar with. And so Daniel 6 is probably, if not the most known story, one of the most known stories for little children or for even, you know, for whoever, that they're familiar with Daniel in the lion's den. Mm-hmm. And that's the story we're going to read today. But after that, it starts getting into, like we discussed last week, the prophecies, the visions, and this one of the only Old Testament books that falls under the genre of an apocalypse or the vision of the apocalypse. So apocalypse, for this is not a pop culture definition of apocalypse. This is apocalyptic literature was an ancient genre of writing, and so to have that, it's just basically a writing that is discussing or describing the end of all things, and that's what we see in this apocalyptic vision. It doesn't have, you know, this isn't like the script for the Terminator or the script for like the Matrix or whatever or what have you. It's just talking about how does all of this kind of come to an end. And so I'm excited to dive in and look at a few things. But let's start with Daniel in the lion's den. So where we ended was in Daniel 5. There was the writing on the wall story with Nebuchadnezzar's son, Belshazzar. Now there's this regime transition from Belshazzar to Darius the Mede. And this picks up with the story of Darius the Mede. One thing, and sort of as we get into this, to give some preface, the way these two chapters are connected, again, I'm pulling back out the NIV Compact Bible Commentary by John Selhammer. He talks about how now Darius the Mede represents one of the four statues that you see in Nebuchadnezzar's original visions, like in chapter 2. And so now Darius is, whether it's the chest of gold or the midsection of silver or bronze or whatever it might be, this is a part of that fulfillment of that vision. And now there's a very specific sort of conclusion that the reader is meant to draw, and Daniel reveals that at the end. But it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom, and over them three presidents, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps should give an account, to give account, so that the king might suffer no loss. In other words, this is the Medo-Persian Empire. This is the region of the Chaldeans. And now this empire is so big that they need not one, but three presidents, and under them 120 members of the Senate and the House of Representatives, if you would have put it in an American language. But there's these three, under rulers that all report to the king. Daniel happens to be one of them. So that's significant, right? Daniel has now survived three regime changes: Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, now Darius the Mede. Then Daniel became distinguished above all the other presidents and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. If you want to know about sort of Daniel's rise to influence and kind of sort of the Old Testament theology, go back and listen to this first part on Daniel. But there's part of what Daniel is highlighting, what God is highlighting through Daniel, is as God's people are now taken into captivity, as Judah is being taken into captivity, God is still proving himself faithful as the God over these foreign powers that took over Judah and Jerusalem. And Daniel is the representative that continues to rise to influence even over those conquerors. Then the presidents and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom, but they could find no ground for complaint or any fault because he was faithful and no error or fault was found in him. So they set out to do this kind of crazy legal thing where they convinced Darius the Mede, which I spent some time trying to research that, of trying to figure out, like, why would, if Darius is such a smart, because that seems like such an easy scheme, right? Of like, oh, well, we're going to make it illegal to pray to any god other than Darius the king for 30 days, you know? And then Darius is like, okay, sure, here, I'll sign that. Like, there's got to be something more to it than, like, he's just dumb. But that seems dumb.
Yeah, it does. But I think that God had his hand in that because he knew what he was going to do at the end.
Right.
He was going to bring glory to himself. And Darius was going to decree that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is going to be the God that they would worship.
See, I think that's a very – I love that you said that, Chris, because I think that's a very, like – that's a very ordinary, like, if we were sitting in a connect group, somebody would have come to that conclusion of, like, wow, look, even in Darius kind of being deceived, God had his hand in that, maybe.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that's a perfectly reasonable interpretation of that text. Like, Hugh, what jumps out of you? Like, why was this, what does this, it, could there be something more than meets the eye?
I mean, there definitely could be, but I think I sit with Chris of just, you know, like, you know, maybe it's not for us to know exactly why Darius was deceived. Or
I mean,
how
we clearly have no other examples of world rulers making stupid
decisions.
That's
right. Yeah. Yeah. But just so that, like, everything had to happen in a certain way so that God's glory would be shown. I mean, I definitely just agree with Chris of, you know, that it had to happen in such a succinct and perfect way.
Hmm. Right. So that's the rest of the story, is that these other presidents and satraps taught Darius into coming up with this law. He establishes the law, part of the Medo-Persian Empire. So once the king sets something into law, it can't be changed. Then they come back and find that we can't get Daniel in trouble for anything other than his devotion to Yahweh. And so they catch Daniel praying in this 30-day time period to Yahweh. And then they go back to Darius and they're like, hey, look, he's praying to somebody that's not you. And Darius regrets that. He tries to find any legal way to get him out of it. But they say in verse 15, know, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or ordinance that the king establishes can be changed. Darius is not happy about this. Then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. The king declared to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you. A stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that nothing can be changed concerning Daniel. Then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him. Then at break of day, the king arose, went in haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. I think all these emotion words, all these feeling words are meant to be in there, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
That they're supposed to draw the reader's attention to how personal and emotional this was for Darius. And then all of the faith language that he begins to use. Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me because I was found blameless before him and also before you, O king. I have done no harm. Then the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no kind of harm was found on him because he had trusted in his God. And the king commanded, and these men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions, they, their children, and their wives. And before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered and broke all their bones in pieces. Okay, so the punctuation of the reading, or really the whole point of the reading, is really unpacked there in 25 through 27. But just like we said last time, like, the point is not all of the anger that Darius displays and throwing in the women and children and the people. It's to highlight in this specific scene that God has won over the heart of yet another Persian king. That even as Judah is in captivity, even here, God is preserving his people and causing them to become of the highest level of influence. And we see that in the next couple of verses. But anything in your commentary, Chris, or anything so far that yours covers, Q?
Yeah, I see that no matter what the world tries to throw on a believer, that God's able to deliver. Mm-hmm. Daniel, sure enough, was going to be eaten by those lions. Nobody in their right mind would have thought anything different.
Right.
But through his perseverance and his prayer, God was able to deliver him from the lion's den, just like he's able to deliver us mm-hmm. from the world as well. Something I did see that really kind of stood out is that even King Darius, when he was about to throw Daniel in the lion's den, he looked at Daniel and he said, may your God protect you and deliver you from this. So Daniel was so full of the Spirit and so full of God's presence and that even an unbeliever saw that and realized not only the devotion, but I guess the power of God that was upon Daniel at the time, yeah. and that the God was able to deliver him from that.
Yeah.
And so that's a reminder to us that we should be very careful about how we conduct ourselves, mm-hmm. that when we're in the world, we need to conduct ourselves in a way that unbelievers will see the Spirit of God upon us as well.
Yeah, and I think in there too, like, you even see Darius sort of in process, right? Like, he,
yes.
at the moment of most despair, like, Daniel had become beloved to Darius, and I'm sure Darius wouldn't have said, well, it's because of your God that I find you so valuable. It's the life that Daniel lived that made him irreplaceable to Darius. And then in the moment of most despair, he calls upon that God because there was nothing else to call on, right?
Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that crazy?
It's a picture of my life.
Amen. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, and that's a great point, Chris. I mean, I think, like, it was both, like, clearly evidence of the Spirit of God in your life that, you know, has brought you to the place of being in ministry. But it was also how you conducted yourself, right? It was the life that you lived. It was the disciples you made. It was the way you shared the gospel, you know, like, and so that's what made Chris irreplaceable in our workplace. Now, apply that to a listener, apply that to your workplace. Like, conduct yourself, yes, with high character and be shameless about your faith, but also be really good at your job.
That's right.
Daniel,
be irreplaceable as possible.
And that's not just like that's not like pseudo Bible science. That's like, that's what the text says in Daniel 6, right? It says that Darius is now the king of this kingdom, and but he set 120 satraps and three presidents. But then among those three presidents, Daniel distinguished himself between 122 other leaders. Like, we should be so excellent at our jobs that people have questions about the God that we serve.
Absolutely. And so I can't agree with you more.
Yeah. That's one thing that I see there as far as like a theology of vocation from Daniel that you could pull out. But then I think too, maybe something that Chris, you brought out of being in the midst of a circumstance, like a lion's den circumstance. I think back to what Daniel has already established in his writing through the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego scene with the fiery furnace. We have the, but if he doesn't deliver us.
We will not bow.
But if not, right, be it known, we will not worship you. We will not worship your statue.
We're going to continue to worship God.
Exactly. Same for Daniel. Like, it's so clear theologically that Daniel doesn't have to repeat himself, right?
Yep.
And so just for the reader, like, he's already established a but if not theology. And now in Daniel 6 in the lion's den, he doesn't report exactly how he conducted himself. But it does say when he survived it, he's like, I was found righteous and innocent before God, but hey, I was also innocent before you.
Yep.
Like, there, you had no cause for throwing me in here.
And he gave God the glory right off the rip, too. Yeah. I mean, right out of the den. Mm-hmm. God. It was all God.
It was all God. Yep.
You know, you said something at the beginning about this being one of the most, probably one of the most well-known stories in the Bible, probably in the Old Testament for sure. We hear all the time, people getting thrown to the lions. Right. And that's just in our everyday conversation. And this is where it comes from.
How's work going? I feel like my boss really throwing me to the lines.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exactly right. Like, there's something in there for that too. I think one of the macro theological lessons of Daniel is how come God is able to produce faithfulness from a wicked king, seemingly not in the land of Jerusalem, when he couldn't get that type of devotion from his people when they had access to the temple.
Mm.
And so I think there's something in there of like, the whole point that Daniel is trying to communicate in all of these scenes is that God is about heartfelt devotion to himself. He wants his people to be devoted to him at a heart level, not in a temple obedience level. The temple was just a means to an end for people to have access to his presence. And Daniel is really, in a lot of ways, unveiling to us as the reader. Like, this is why he writes it. This is why the Spirit of God leads him to write it, is for people to understand in all places, at all times, God is there and he is king over that domain. So let's get into that. Verse 25, then King Darius wrote to all, again, we laughed about this last week, but then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages. How you feel about writing a letter to all peoples and all nations, right? And that dwell in all the earth. Here's my letter to the world. Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble in fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. And he who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions.
That's an awesome set of verses right there. I mean, yeah, you could preach a New Testament sermon on that.
Yeah, and I think that's the point. I think that's the intention. Is it's meant to be a you know, again, nerd time, this is meant to be an intertextual link to the previous chapter.
And a foreshadow of Christ,
mm-hmm,
and his kingdom everlasting.
Right. So back to 4, you see this language at the end of 4. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heavens, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. So now this is two generations of kings that God has reached with his in turning their hearts to himself.
So right? Do you think Darius and Nebuchadnezzar are going to be in heaven?
I think so.
I think so too. I mean,
I think I think possibly, I don't know, but I mean, like, Nebuchadnezzar seems to be influenced by Daniel, seems to fall away, then he's humiliated, and it seems like sincere devotion at the end. Darius, I don't know enough like external sources to know, because it seems like Xerxes says something similar in Ezra and Nehemiah, you know, but like how that sincere devotion works out, because it doesn't seem like their empires turn in that direction, you know. Maybe they personally did, but we know from Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar didn't turn, his family didn't turn in that direction.
No, they didn't.
But now we have Darius the Mede.
It's always been about an individual and not about a turning a whole family. It's always one heart at a time.
Yeah. Yep. All right. I know there's some stuff in that commentary on this particular portion. It says the king was encouraged to issue a decree, yada, yada, yada. C. Moore has challenged Daniel's statement concerning the irrevocability of the Persian law, but there is evidence to support the book's accuracy at this point. Some French dude relates Diodorus of Sicily, in fact, reports the case of a man put to death under Darius III in 336 to 330, even though he was known to be perfectly innocent. Darius III immediately repented and blamed himself for having committed such a great error, but it was impossible to have undone what had been done by royal authority. So that was back to the... I'm just saying that there are external historical sources that
prove
lend
that
itself.
Laws couldn't be changed once they made a decree.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry you're innocent, but I already said you got to die, so we're going to go ahead and chop your head off.
Well, and that's a good point for the believer, right, is that not every law is a just law.
Absolutely not.
And so there is a time for the believer to stand up against unjust laws. So, again, that's another piece of application from Daniel. But that textual link there with the end of that section is really important. Selhammer kind of hints on that. He says... at the close of the fourth episode in chapter 6, Darius proclaimed that God is the living God and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. These words, which are identical to those in Daniel's interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream in 244, serve further to link the events of this chapter to the interpretation of the dream in chapter 2. Just as the focus of Daniel's interpretation of the dream was the eternal kingdom of God, so the focus of the series of narratives that follow is also the eternal kingdom of God. That's the key. That's the focus that I want to focus in on right there. I'm going to read that again. Just as the focus of Daniel's interpretation of the dream from chapter 2 was the eternal kingdom of God, so the focus of the series of narratives that follow is also the eternal kingdom of God. The message of the narratives thus continuously reinforces Daniel's interpretation of the dream. There is also a link between the events of chapter 6 and Daniel's vision in chapter 7. Just as Nebuchadnezzar dreamed of a statue with a golden head and then made a golden statue, so also in chapter 6, Daniel was thrown into a den of lions. Then, in chapter 7, saw a vision of wild beasts, the first of which was a lion. Moreover, Daniel is rescued from the wild beasts just as the saints of the Most High are to be rescued from the fourth beast in chapter 7, 21 through 22. Again, so we made a point last week, and I want to go ahead and bring it up again, that a lot of the specific interpretation of what we're going to get into with the visions, there is both an already and a not yet fulfillment of some of these visions.
That's hard for a lot of people to grasp.
Yeah. And it's impossible for all of us to grasp exactly, right? Like, but that principle, that already but not yet language, is very important for keeping the believer between the ditches of how to understand visions, apocalyptic visions, and prophecy. There's an already and a not yet. Some of what we're going to see, so like just, you know, let me tease that out just to make sure it's really, really clear. He says, just as Nebuchadnezzar dreamed of a statue with a golden head in chapter 2 and then made a golden statue. So also in chapter 6, Daniel was thrown into a den of lions. That already happened. Now here's what's not yet. Moreover, Daniel is rescued from the wild beast, just as the saints of the Most High are to be rescued from the fourth beast. The fourth beast is a not yet.
Right.
We can already count on God delivering us from every beast as believers. We can whatever part of what Daniel's trying to communicate is whatever world authority winds up being put in place in your life, Jesus will deliver us already, and sometimes not yet.
That's right.
And so it doesn't mean that every believer, like Iranian believers right now, they are not yet freed from an unjust government. They are not yet delivered from even a satanic government. But in eternity, they already are under the dominion of Jesus Christ. So there's an already, but also a not yet dynamic with prophecy and with visions. And so that's what, now let's dig into that with Daniel chapter 7. Anything on Daniel 6 from your commentary, Chris?
No, just that as soon as Daniel came out of the lion's den, that's a picture of us coming out of the lion's den of the world, that King Darius threw his accusers into the lion's den, they were destroyed. Mm-hmm. Same thing that's going to happen to unbelievers at the end, too.
Right. Q, anything from the Bible, the study Bible footnotes?
Nope.
Okay. So what I would say, I wish I could have this on video and kind of, it would, you know, it's not even, I can describe it, I guess, with words. But I would say we're going from broad and simple to more narrow and complicated with the visions. Like, we've gotten all the easy ones out of the way. The other ones are going to be a little bit more complicated to understand, and the text to us currently as readers, it seems less clear. I think there's a lot of different directions, a lot of different ways people interpret lots of different portions of Daniel. But my encouragement, my pastoral note to our listeners is we do need to defer to how Daniel helps us interpret Daniel. And I've tried to lay out how so far Daniel has helped us interpret the prophecies and visions that he's already seen or already laid out in Daniel 1 through 6. Now 7 through 12, we need to apply the same hermeneutic, which is how do we go about interpreting the science of interpreting the Bible. That's what hermeneutics is. And so that same intertextual nature of Daniel 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, we got to apply that same thing. So Daniel 7, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, so we're back, right, to Belshazzar, not Darius. Daniel saw a dream and visions in his head of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, Arise, devour much flesh. After this, I looked, and behold, another like a leopard with four wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke its broken pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the little horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood before me, and asked him the truth concerning all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of the things. Okay, that's where I wanted to read to. What happens here, again, is a more complicated vision. What I would say is, unless there is some intertextual interpretation given, you and I cannot make heads or tails of chapter 7, 1 through 8.
Yeah, like a bear with ribs in its mouth. I mean, what do you make of that?
I had I text Matthew Mallard this the other day, but I had a dream that I had all my hunting clothes on. I had my rifle, and I looked out, and you guys, Chris especially, you'll know in Q from hunting as a kid, like there's like a 14-point deer, and in South Georgia, those aren't common, but it's like 70 yards from me and acts like it has no idea that I'm there. And it's just running around in the open, just prancing around.
Sounds perfect.
Yeah. You would think this was going to be a good dream. I'm like walking to my stand, but you know how dreams are. I like turn around and then there's like a house. It's Matthew Mallard's house. But I'm like, originally I was in the middle of the woods, and now I turn around, I'm in Matthew Mallard's yard. And he walks out and he's like standing next to me in plain clothes. And I was like, you see that massive deer? And he's like, yep, see him all the time. And I'm like, do you know whose property that deer is on? And he's like, yeah, we got camera pictures of him everywhere. And I'm like, look at this thing. I'm like handing him my rifle, like, look down scope, look at this thing. And he's like, yep, big old deer. And there's like, there's like 7 of these massive deer. And this one in particular is just way bigger. And then I woke up.
Like you need to go sit on Matthew Mallard's porch.
I texted him. I was like, I think this means we need to be hunting buddies. Like, you need to buy a piece of land that has a 14-point buck, and we need to go hunting. But, like, I have no idea what that dream, even though it was my dream, I have no idea what there. I don't think, unless the Spirit of God reveals it, that it means anything other than I had a dream about hunting, you know, and Matthew Mallard is a friend of mine, right? So, it's just, like, I think that's where I just share that, because I wouldn't want our folks to feel like something is hanging in the balance of them interpreting and reading the tea leaves of their own dreams. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they mean something. Most of the time, they mean nothing, right?
But in this context, with Daniel, this does mean something.
Yeah. So here would be my hermeneutic for interpreting some of your dreams. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all this. If one of the angels of the Lord appears to you and you have a chance to ask him what the dream means,
go for it.
Go for it. by all means. I've never experienced that. I have had dreams that I have later had deja vu about of like, mm-hmm. It was like a little snapshot of the future, and I had no idea at the time. I woke up, and then but later when it came to pass, I had zero control over the event. It just was a coincidence.
There's no such thing.
As you know what I mean.
But even then, what you're trying to convey is like, don't spend your life like trying to interpret all your dreams, because some of them maybe mean something, but others they just might be dreams.
The power of prophecy lies in the hand of the Lord.
That's right.
Yeah. We have been given a very specific task. In the process of making disciples and reaching people with the gospel, like Daniel did, right? Daniel was faithful to be an influence in Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, and Darius's life. And in the process of doing that, of fulfilling your assignment, if God gives you miraculous dreams and visions, praise God. But he will confirm those things. But part of what I'm also getting at, part of the other application I would make from Daniel 7 is he talks about these four different beasts. All four are enemy spiritual forces. That's what they signify. The eagle, the bear, whatever, all the different ones that pop up. Like, these are anti-human spiritual forces. And we are... there, people, if you give yourself over to that type of shamanic, like sensational type craving those types of experiences, or thinking that you can only hear from God through dreams, visions, a word of knowledge, like if you start seeking such, and I'm all for like charismatic. I believe in the gifts. I believe in speaking in tongues. I believe in all of that stuff. But I'm just saying that overwhelmingly craving the sensational, when in actuality, God works a lot of times through very practical, very natural means. And so that's more of a pastoral note. I don't think that's what Daniel is. That's just like a side journey there for what I see in the text. But I think for the purposes of interpreting prophecy specifically is the intertextual need that we have to, if we're going to understand it best when the text interprets the text. So that's all I wanted to drive out there. So at the end, he says, verse 16, I approached one of those, stood there and asked him the truth concerning all this. So he told me and made known to me, he made known to me, the spirit made known to me the interpretation of the things. These four beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. Again, this is back to Belshazzar. So now we've got Darius the Mede, and then there's going to be other kings that come after him, which we know from Ezra and Nehemiah is Cyrus, and then Xerxes, right? These are the ones that in some order are to come. But it says, these four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever, and ever. So again, this kingdom is already, because of Christ, mm-hmm. that's how we read Daniel now, is that the kingdom of God is here, mm-hmm. but it is not yet, what the word that we use is consummated. The kingdom has not, it's not visual yet. It is in reality, but it is not the visible kingdom of God that we see in Revelation. So the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever and ever. Anything there, Chris?
I mean, I got all kinds of stuff on there, but I don't think we got enough time to get into it right now.
All right. I wanted to slow down on that one, because I think all the ones after this, again, begin to get a little bit more squirrely, a little bit more, but also repetitive. Like, there's a few more things maybe that I could highlight, but I mean, the big things for me wanting to leave sort of an overall like point that like you need to bring sort of an already but not yet framework to understand prophecy, the intertextual dynamic of like the text helps you interpret the text. Sometimes there's a very plain meaning even in prophecy. And sometimes there's We just have to trust that the fulfillment of what that actually is going to look like, we don't know yet.
That's right.
It's for the future. But then, so here's an example. We'll bounce around in this regard. But I was listening to a podcast while I was on the cruise of Daniel chapter 9, that he predicts these 70 weeks or the seven times of time, or you know, there's lots of ways that it can go. But there is, on the one hand, an already fulfillment of that 70 weeks of time. There's this intertestamental period time king who defiles the temple. But then there's also the future, the way, 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 way future of, we don't know what the desolation, the, what's the word I'm looking for? The desolation of,
something else.
It's like rhymes.
Oh my gosh.
The devastation. In Revelation, you're talking about? Yeah, like something of something.
I can't believe we can't think of this right now. I mean, we've only talked about it 400,000 times.
Yeah.
Desecration?
Something like this. Not desecration.
Desecration or desolation or something. But somebody's screaming at the radio right
now.
Anyway,
they attribute that to.
That's it. That's it.
The abomination of desolation. Thank you.
Yeah.
You heard it here first.
A lot of people attribute that to some of that already being fulfilled in Antiochus Epiphanes.
Whenever he
went into the Jewish temple and slaughtered a hog.
Right.
But we see that, a partial fulfillment in that. But then we also know that we're going to see the Antichrist in the third temple. Depending on how you look at your eschatology,
sure.
you might see the Antichrist in the third temple declaring himself to be God, and that would be a complete fulfillment of that scripture as well.
And I would say, and I definitely lean more more macro theological in a lot of those things, in that I think that Daniel is preparing the reader for, no matter what foreign kingdom you wind up in, follower of Yahweh, that Yahweh is still in control. Yeah. I think that's the macro point that Daniel's trying to communicate to his Jewish audience. Now, for us as Christians, we apply that same logic to, like, no matter where we wind, because, right, we're sent to all nations. Whatever nation we wind up in, like, we can trust that Yahweh is still in control. That is a dominion that still belongs to the Lord our God.
Yes.
And same thing with, like, these, whether the abomination of desolation or whatever the right phrase is, like, I think that's part of what John is communicating in 1st and 2nd John, is like, the Antichrist is the one who declares Jesus is not God, right? That
spirit's prevalent right now, isn't it?
Always. I mean, and it always has been, right? And you just got back from the land of John, right? In Ephesus, right? Like, he looked around and saw all of that and was like, yeah, there's Antichrist everywhere. Anybody that would deny that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, that's the spirit of the Antichrist. Now, in Revelation, could there be a figure that rises up? Yeah, very well could be, you know, and it seems like there's consistently figures that rise up that deny the deity and sonship of Christ. So go ahead.
No, it's just hard for me to keep my mouth shut right now.
That's another podcast.
I know, it'd be really, really easy to get into the little horn and all that she's talking about right here.
Go for it.
The little horn here is the Antichrist. He's speaking blasphemies against God, and that's the beginning of the desolation of the temple, is when he talks to God, or he blasphemes God, makes himself up to be God in the temple. Without getting into eschatology and all of that, really.
Well, no, that's why we're covering it. That's why we're diving into it. So you feel free to get into it.
The one thing that I really wanted to bring out is, when I was looking at my phone, is I would encourage everybody that listens to this, after they read this chapter, to go to Ezekiel 1 and read the description of God on his throne and the fire, and see how much alike it is that Ezekiel and Daniel had the same sort of vision of God on his throne, and the fire and the peals of thunder and the the eyes of fire and the flaming, you know, the white hair, right, and just all of that.
Yeah.
Just how much, to me, that just shows more proof that these were actual visions from God, and that they were seeing what Daniel was seeing, what Ezekiel was seeing, what some of the other prophets were seeing, was really prophetic dreams from God, because they're seeing the same images, even though they're separated by time and space.
Right. Well, and I want to say that they're contemporaries, that Daniel and Ezekiel are contemporaries, but they're separated by location. I know, so it says, I know Daniel, yeah. So the prophet Daniel was a contemporary of the prophet Ezekiel. He is even mentioned in Ezekiel 14, chapter 20 and 28, verse 3. But he's clearly living in a foreign land.
Yes.
So it's not like Daniel and Ezekiel aren't necessarily interacting.
Right.
They're completely, to Chris's point, is all I'm trying to add credence to, is that they were contemporaries, but these are completely independent events describing the same God, mm-hmm, in fantastic fashion, right? Of like it feels weird to even mention this, but I mean, it's just become so popular with Billy Carson and Joe Rogan and different people. Like, they take that Ezekiel passage, Ezekiel 1, Ezekiel 14, Daniel 7, these different things, as evidence of aliens, mm-hmm, as evidence of flying saucers and fiery circles and things like that. And that's become very popular in the American sort of pop culture scene.
Hogwash.
Yeah, I just... it's people will do anything to deny the supernatural.
Exactly. They will credit works of God to anything except God.
If any of you want to hear somebody, if you are a science-minded person, you want to hear somebody on the team of science absolutely make sense of a supernatural worldview, go look up John Lennox. He's a mathematician, and he's got a cool British accent. It'll be right up your alley. And he makes complete sense of the logical necessity of God while also upholding being a person of science. So, but all that to say, and Chris, please continue to interject any eschatology that you want to talk about. So the little horn he's mentioning is chapter 7, verse 8, I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. But then, as I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. In other words, that's a lot of people.
Yep.
The court sat in judgment, and the books were open. And again, not again to get off on my hobby horse of topics, but to me, I see here again that God exists in community, and it makes what this helps in a very subtle way adds is why God created people, because he desired to have an ongoing, unique relationship with us. Why does he now choose to send his only son, that whosoever would believe would not perish but would have everlasting life? Because he wants to return us into the proximity of his courtroom. Mm. He wants to extend. That's why going all the way back, just so that everybody sees the complete connection of the Bible. In Genesis 1, he said, let us make man in our image. Mm-hmm. Let them be fruitful, multiply across the face of the earth. We were supposed to be his dominion ruler representatives on earth.
That's right. And so in Genesis, after Adam and Eve sinned, and God is walking through the garden in the still of the evening, and he's looking for him, he calls out to Adam, Adam, where are you at? God was looking for his people, and that sin separated us. What he's trying to do is to bring us back into that original relationship.
Exactly. And now fast forward to Daniel. This is the beautiful symmetry of the Bible, is that in this, it's saying in the midst of all of these rebellious beasts and horns, the Ancient of Days takes his seat, mm-hmm, and he issues judgment.
Yep.
But he's the reason Jesus died on behalf of humanity is to return us back to that courtroom. The courtroom is not like, you know, the DUI court I went to when I was 19. It is the throne room of his presence. It's
exactly
the access to the most close proximity to him as we're ruling alongside as redeemed heirs, right? We're redeemed mm-hmm. into the position of co-heir with Christ. Not like that's why Paul writes later and says, do you not know that we will judge angels?
That's a lot to think about.
Well, and that's and it gives credit to why in Ezekiel, Isaiah, and Jeremiah that this one who rebelled, Satan was envious of humanity. That's why he rebelled. That's my eschatology. That's why Satan rebels and leads other angels. It's like, hey, this is bullcrap. Like, look how beautiful we are. And now look at these puny people. There's no way. We can't let God get away. Look, he is undermining our beauty. And so he leads this entire rebellion of, like, because clearly this can't be the sound judgment of the one true God. You guys need to listen to me, right? That's the Ezekiel 14.
Isn't that the voice that's rocking around throughout the world right now? You know, don't listen to God, listen to me.
Exactly. So the Ancient of Days sits down to do, so anyway, so that's Daniel 7. Where did I read to there? 16?
Yeah.
Okay, so, and again, another New Testament theology link. I don't know that we're going to make it through all of 12, but we're just trying to give interpretive principles for all of Daniel. That you get now the Ancient of Days. That's a consistent Old Testament reference to God, to Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
But then the Son of Man, that's what Jesus refers to himself the most often in the Gospels, as the Son of Man.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's... that we see that here in the book of Daniel. All right, so let's pick up in 17, or let's pick up in 19. Then I desired to know the truth about the fourth beast. And I'm going back to this because, Chris, you brought up the little horn, and I think he unpacks some more of that maybe in over the course of this chapter. Then I desired to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying, with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, in which devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet, and about the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn that came up and before which 3 of them fell, the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things that seemed greater than its companions. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them. Saints, you could say holy ones. It doesn't have to be... because what happens here is we read back into this New Testament Christians, but when actually it's saying holy ones, ones who are set apart. So it doesn't necessarily have to be referring to Christians. Daniel doesn't have the category of Christian.
Right, but he's still saved.
Daniel for sure, but that's not the point that there's no question about that, but that's not the point that Daniel's trying to make.
Exactly.
Is not that he's not using saint as in these Christians. He's saying holy ones. These ones who are set apart. I lost my place. Where was I?
21.
As I looked, made war. Oh, there it is. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High. And the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. So again, not to harp on this point, but let's read it as holy ones. As I looked, this horn made war with the holy ones and prevailed over them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given for the holy ones of the Most High. And the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom, when the holy ones possessed the kingdom. So when did the Ancient of Days come and give judgment for the holy ones?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. He hasn't yet. This is a future prophecy.
So I would say he already has placed judgment for our sins on Christ.
Mm-hmm.
He has not yet delivered us from the sinful world because he still is wanting to extend. That's why Paul looks back and says, in his grace and mercy, he passed over the sins of the past to delay the judgment of them. He put them on his son.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this regard, even the sins of Darius, even the sins of Nebuchadnezzar, he had passed over judgment on them by his mercy, and he put those already on Christ. But he's not yet judged the entire earth because we're still here, right? Trump is, and whoever is still president, right? Like,
I think we've got another, you know, already and not yet situation right here,
right,
where we can read both into this prophecy. We can read both that exactly what you're saying, but then we can also read into the future of it as well, the future deliverance of the saints at the defeat of the Antichrist.
Exactly. Yeah, that's also, I think, that's a good example of, like, is there also a future, is it also future telling? Is it foretelling something, right?
Yes.
It's forthtelling, meaning that it is telling us a spiritual truth and reality that it is looking into the future to ascertain. It's forthtelling.
As only God's word can do.
Right. But it's also foretelling that there could be a future dynamic.
Yes.
But then he continues to unpack that. Daniel does. And this is how he explains it. Verse 23, thus he said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms, and it shall devour the whole earth, and trample it down, and break it to pieces. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones, and shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints, or the holy ones of the Most High, and shall think to change the times and the law. And then shall be given into his hand in a time, times, and a half a time. But the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away, and be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. Their kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominion shall serve and obey them. Here is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me, and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. So there's a lot of directions. But again, so here's one sort of macro point again. Daniel tells us in broad strokes what the point of it is, which was what we've already covered in. It's the same language in Daniel 6. He is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. Mm-hmm. Same as Daniel chapter 4 with Nebuchadnezzar. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. That language is meant to be very closely linked in there. Chris, jump in there and see. Just tell me, like, what some of your as it relates to, because there is stuff in there, like there's a lot of directions you can go with, well, which kingdom was which? Because obviously for us on the other side of the cross, we're thinking a little bit about Rome.
We're thinking a lot about Rome. If you go all the way back to verse 5 and you see the bear, we know now by looking at the past that the bear is Medo-Persia. The 3 ribs in its mouth represent the 3 sections of the Babylonian Empire, which were sacked by the Medes and the Persians under Cyrus. The leopard, you can see Greece, it has wings of a bird because of the speed at which Greece took over the world. Mm-hmm. You know, they took over the world in 13 years. You know, Alexander the Great conquered the whole known world in 13 years.
Right.
And then died at 33 years old, which is another thing that kind of shocked me. That he died the same age that Christ was crucified.
Mm.
And so,
I mean, not related, but I'm also 33.
Oh, sir? Dang. He's also 33.
Well, we're not going to lose you yet, sir.
Never know.
The fourth beast was different from the others, but it had other characteristics. It was exceedingly strong, huge iron teeth, the Roman Empire. And so you start, as we are on this side of history, then we can look back at some of this prophetic, apocalyptic literature, and we can start applying some of what we know now and see what he was speaking to at the time, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it takes a lot of study to be able to figure it out, mm-hmm. but thankfully there's people way smarter than me that have studied this before, and I can read their works.
Right.
So the something that really stands out in verses 15 through 18. Daniel is perplexed, and he's anxiously perplexed about these visions that he's seeing. And so I want to comfort everybody that's reading or that's listening to this to know that it's okay to be perplexed when you start reading stuff like this and not understand it. Because even the guy that had the dreams was perplexed by it.
Yeah.
You know, so don't beat yourself up over it. Just continue to study and continue to pray.
Morgan kind of drew that out last week, too, of like she had talked to people and they were just like, man, I just don't know. Like, how could I ever understand Daniel? It's like, well, Daniel didn't understand Daniel. Mm-hmm. You know,
exactly.
Like, you know, there's something to like. But it does tell us and help us understand more of who God is and what he's like. And it's essential. It's essential for us to know. So, you know, all of that, like, I think on the one hand, I am, like, I can see how some of the pieces line up of Greece and Rome and these different ones. But, you know, I'm always a little bit skeptical of them being exact fulfillment. But this, you know, here's how Sellhammer approaches it. Again, that I'm not saying one way or another what I agree or disagree with. I'm just saying here's another scholar's perspective on verses 15 through 27. We offer two classic interpretations here. An older Jewish interpretation sees Israel as taking the land from Edom, which is the fourth kingdom, Rome. The horn of verse 8 made war with Israel, the saints. The ten horns are ten kings from the same kingdom. After these kings, another will arise, who is Titus, the Roman king, Emperor Titus. He will oppress, I'm just making sure we don't think it's Titus that follows Timothy. Is Titus one of the Roman kings? He will oppress Israel and attempt to get them to transgress their feast days and laws. No one knows how long this will prevail, a time, times, and half a time. A modern interpretation sees the saints as the saved of all ages as well as the holy angels. The kingdom possessed by the saints of the Most High, while eternal, may easily include the millennial kingdom and the eternal rule of God that follows. The little horn is the outstanding person at the end of the ages who will be destroyed when the kingdom comes from heaven. A time, times, and half a time refer to the last 3.5 years preceding the second advent of Christ, who will bring in the final form of God's kingdom on earth. There is nothing in chapter 7 of Daniel to alter the conclusion that the fourth empire is Rome, that its final state has not yet been fulfilled, and that it is a genuine prophetic revelation of God's program for human history. So Sellhammer lands at, yes, on the one hand, it's Rome, and it's those king, those emperors, and on the other hand, it has to do with the end of time.
Yeah, and I would fall in that same category.
Yeah, and I think Sellhammer would... I don't know if he's a premillennialist. I don't know if he's an amillennialist, but he's definitely not a postmillennialist. So, we're at 1:05, we really did exactly what I hoped we would do, which is give broader strokes, you know, highlights on how to interpret visions and prophecy and apocalyptic literature. I think part of what Daniel would want us to walk away with, what I hope our listeners walk away with, is God cares for his people.
Mm-hmm.
He protects his people. It doesn't mean that we won't be in extremely precarious situations, but I think it should both encourage and embolden the believer that God has them in all places at all times. Mm-hmm. It should motivate the missionary to keep going, that you can go to all nations and God will be present with you there. But it should also strengthen every believer in all churches that God's kingdom is the only kingdom that stands forever. And he has an economy that we can't see and that we can't control. But neither can the rulers over whatever kingdom, whatever nation you preside in or reside in, but that we can trust God in all places that we live, and that God can change the hearts of people. He changed the hearts of Darius. He changed the hearts of Nebuchadnezzar. We see later in Daniel chapter 10, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a word was revealed to Daniel. So he's again... And at that time, under another Medo-Persian ruler and Cyrus. And so there's more in the book of Daniel with interactions with Michael, interactions with Gabriel, the 70 weeks. You know, there's some stuff in there about, you know, Daniel begins to seemingly read the book of Jeremiah. That begins to get really interesting. And he's like, huh, if I'm doing my math right. And then he has this interaction with Gabriel or Michael, one of the two. Is Gabriel, and it's like, huh, it's like the math, he's like, well, it's not exactly that math, it's a different math. Mm. And you know how we, you know, all of that to say,
common,
like,
core,
huh,
common core math.
Yeah. Common core math. Yeah, I need a T98 to get me through some of this math. But it's, you know, again, time belongs to the Lord. I think is the big point. It's that we don't, Jesus tells us, like, the end's going to come like a thief in the night. Like, we're not going to be able to predict exactly when it comes. Like, some of it can be really interesting, like it is for Chris. Chris really enjoys thinking about eschatology, studying, reading it, and it's awesome. It helps me because I don't like thinking about it, but he challenges me to read it and to think about it, and I enjoy talking about it with him because he's passionate about it. And so in our groups, I hope as you dig into some of this, like, one of the few things that I would say would be a wrong interpretation of Daniel is to come away with fear, right?
Absolutely.
To come away with any type of fear or anxiety about how the world works, or that God's not in control, or that God won't protect his people, that would be the wrong interpretation of Daniel.
I think that throughout Daniel, and throughout every book in the Bible,
right,
you see God's in control, God's in control, God's in control, God's in control. Even in a lion's den, no matter what, even in a fire, God's in control, God's in control. His kingdom's going to be everlasting.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're supposed to understand all of this on a first run.
Mm.
I don't think we're supposed to understand it on the 17th run.
Mm-hmm.
If we were able to read our Bible one time through and know it all, we would put it down and never read it again.
That's great.
Part of the reason it's hard to understand and God wrote it the way he did was so that way we keep digging and we keep digging and we keep digging. And as we dig, we're transformed more and more from the inside out to be more in the image of Christ.
Yeah, clip that. That's the highlight of the podcast. That's what
Bam.
We're going to. Q, anything?
I don't know. It's related, but a little unrelated. But it just makes me think about, you said yesterday during the baptisms at the 11 a.m., just about, like, the miracle, like, that it's a miracle. And I think it's easy to read a lot of these Old Testament and New Testament stories, and you see, like, the phrase, like, God moved in so-and-so's heart. It just makes me think a lot of, like, if you can't relate to this, just think about how God moved in your heart. Like, mm-hmm. imagine if Daniel was, or any person was right in there, like, and God moved in Chris's heart in this way. Like,
mm-hmm.
I think it's the same God that moved in Pharaoh's heart, that moves in Nebuchadnezzar's heart. Like, it's the same God that's moving in our heart, and that is a miracle. Like, yes, you know, he moved in this giant king's heart who was oppressing and doing all these things, but, like, it's the same God that moved in your heart, and that's the same miracle that these people experience. Like, we can relate to that. It's not about us, but it's the same God that did the same miracle.
I think
that's what really, like, stands out for me as being somebody that is, like, kind of a novice. Like, as you guys are throwing these things around, my head's just ping-ponging back and forth. But, like, that's what I'm reminded of, like, looking at Daniel, of, like, these are the same miracles. It's the same God. I think that's just really cool, especially for, like, a believer that maybe is very, this is a very foreign topic for them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think your humility to just kind of, I think it adds a lot of value to the audience of, like, here's what it should sound like when this is new to you,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, faith seeking understanding.
Yeah.
And I think that's you letting us be a part of that journey in a more public format is very noble. And I think it's really helpful. So, well, good stuff. Well, thank you all for your time. We look forward to being back with you next week. And we love you guys. We'll see you soon.